Listen up. Any signal. Remember, any signal. Gun, double right, close. Gun, double right, close. Half back right. 200 scat. Trouble slant. Thunder. In the name of Lord Jesus Christ, let's go.
Excuse me.
What is it, Wolf? We gotta get up to the line.
I don't believe in God or Allah or the divinity of Jesus, so...
Wolf, this is the NFL. This is football. You gotta believe that stuff. It's mandatory.
Well, I don't. And if there's a God, why is he watching football when there are so many other things he could be doing?
Look... I don't want to have to burn a timeout, but you should definitely read Mere Christianity by C.S. Lewis.
Is that the Narnia dude?
But he's so much more than that.
I think it's okay if Wolf doesn't believe.
In Romans 12:2, it says, "Do not conform to the pattern of this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. Then you will be able to test and approve what God's will is, his good, pleasing, and perfect will."
Right. So if Wolf makes the catch and scores on this play, that proves it's God's will and Jesus is divine.
Oh, come on now. Don't put that on me.
Can we talk about the commercialization of everything? In Mark 4:19, Jesus says, "But the worries of this life, the deceitfulness of wealth, and the desires for other things come in and choke the word, making it unfruitful." I feel like we serve Pepsi, not God.
Oh, we just got flagged for delay of game.
But this is so much more important. I mean, let's really talk about this stuff. Meanwhile, today on The Scramble, the NFL confronts its first atheist player. We take a warm bath in summer TV, and Bernie Sanders' disciples build a Connecticut team. And now he thought the Arizona Cardinals was a Catholic retirement community. Colin McEnroe.
That's right. A little bit later in the show today, we'll catch up with TV critic Roger Catlin, who I think is on the West Coast looking at the rollouts of some of the fall stuff, but also reflecting on summer TV, which is sort of a different thing than it used to be. And then towards the end, I mean, it really is true here in Connecticut, the only presidential candidate on either side of the aisle who has a really active, rumbling, enthusiastic fan base in an organization is Bernie Sanders. I mean, unless I'm missing somebody, I know there's somebody working for, you know, Marco Rubio and stuff, but it seems like it's Bernie. It's like outnumbers everybody 300 to 1 in terms of having people getting excited. So we'll talk to one or two of his supporters towards the end. I'm really excited, though. We're beginning with Tim Kuhn. He's a senior writer for ESPN. I'm a longtime fan. On an old radio station where I used to have to do a daily sports segment, it may have been the case that I reworded some of his excellent jokes from his old Page 2 column, but I think the time window for him to file a lawsuit has now closed. We're here today not to talk about that, but to talk about his piece about Arian Foster. He's a senior writer for ESPN, as I said before. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks, Colin.
So Arian Foster is somebody that we know if we are football fans for his slashing running style. He plays for Houston. He's pretty great. Until I read your piece, I had not realized, A, that he's kind of a rebellious guy in a very generalized sense, and then very specifically, a guy who's willing to openly challenge this notion that the NFL and Jesus walk pretty much hand in hand. So prior to your piece, how well was this known among, let's say, NFL fans, for starters?
Well, Colin, I think his sort of iconoclasm was pretty well known. He's been pretty open about speaking his mind about social issues and sort of popping bubbles where they need to be popped. He has come out and said that he took impermissible benefits when he was playing at Tennessee and sort of did it. He delivered that news sort of unapologetically, so that kind of got people's attention. He's always sort of tiptoed around this idea of being a non-believer, as he puts it. He sort of stays away from the term atheist, but that's the language he speaks, is the language of atheism. So he's talked about religion in the locker room. He's talked about how he doesn't hold conventional beliefs, but this is the first time that he's come out directly and said, "Here I am. I'm a guy who played my whole, public football career in the Bible Belt, first in Tennessee and now in Houston, and I don't believe, let's all try to make the world a little bit easier for both sides by accepting each other." So, he's been known as a different guy and as someone who's not only different but is willing to be perceived as different, which I think are two different things, especially in sports, since so many athletes stay away from saying anything controversial. He's pretty well known in that regard, but I think this time he's sort of, I think probably no longer a secret at this point.
So let's hear what he's butting up against. Here's sort of how athletes talk about God in the course of a typical athletic event.
I want to first thank God because through him all things have been possible in my life.
God is absolutely amazing.
You know that God's in control whether you win or lose, and I think that helps with, you know, me at the end of games.
First of all, I just want to thank God for this opportunity.
God wants us to win the world championship.
I don't know if I go that far, Charles.
I talked to him the other night.
All right, the last, of course, is Charles Barkley, who does, in fact, get direct audiences with God whenever he wants them. So this is, I mean, you know, it's sort of a joke, Tim Kuhn, and sort of not a joke. I mean, it's sort of a joke to, in fact, suppose, and Arian Foster does bring this up in your article, that God wouldn't have something better to do if he existed than worry about the outcome of games. He should be worried about starvation and cataclysm around the world. But it's also, this is really embedded in sports, and as you say, probably nowhere more deeply embedded than in the NFL. Is there any kind of working hypothesis about why it's the NFL as opposed to Major League Baseball?
I don't know. I mean, I think there might be more involved in football is so much more of a physical sport. There's so much more potential for injury that, you know, there might be just more of a reflexive need to sort of thank God for making it through the day, you know? I mean, I think that could be part of it. You know, but it's, those words that we were listening to are things that we have just become numb to, right? But I think when you're someone like Arian Foster and you're on the other side, you hear those things more than we do, you know, more than a Christian does. Or, you know, if you're inside that game and yet you're not part of that certain culture, I think there's a part that you could probably feel a little bit alienated. And I think that that's where he's coming from with a lot of this. And, you know, football has always embraced sort of the military industrial complex, and I think the God and country stuff goes hand in hand. And I think it's become, you know, even if someone's not maybe as devout as they say they are, I think it's become something that they feel almost obligated to do, is to thank God after they win a game. And in some ways, I mean, it almost diminishes religion because it seems so flippant and sort of, I don't know, just sort of unnecessary to talk about that. And you know, it sort of invites, you know, mockery in some ways when, you know, God wanted us to win the championship. It just seems to sort of belittle the whole concept and probably makes it easier for someone like Arian to argue with his teammates in the locker room about, you know, what God's mission is if he or she does exist.
It could be that, I mean, famously, you know, there are no atheists in the foxholes. It could be that football is simply the most violent and dangerous of all games. Therefore, all the more reason to ally yourself with the most powerful entity that you can think of. There's also, you know, been this long linkage between football and the presidency, football and presidential politics. Nixon actually designed a play for the Redskins to run, but typically, pre-Barack Obama, presidents were pretty interested in football. And it's always been said that the one thing we will never have, it'll be a long time before the U.S. has an atheist president. You can't get away with it. It's the one thing that you can't say you are. And so I wonder about this in the NFL. I mean, what are the likely consequences? I think there's probably plenty of NFL players who have a soft, if not agnostic, faith. I don't know what Aaron Rodgers thinks about God. I've never heard him say a word about it, you know. But to get up in a little bit more in the face of this whole question, I don't know. You say that he you quote him as being wondering, well, what's going to happen to endorsements? What's going to happen to this? Will it matter at all?
I think it remains to be seen. It'll probably be determined, Colin, by how he handles the aftermath, you know, and because he was unfortunately injured last week and had surgery on Friday, there hasn't been much response from him to this point. But, you know, I think that there will be, you know, in terms of local things, there might be some people that are a little bit hesitant to attach his name to their product. And then there might be some that are driven to do it because of his openness and his the way that he decided to make this public. So I don't know. I mean, I don't know how much he really depends on endorsements or cares about endorsements. He's a pretty frugal guy, and I don't know that he's been lending his name to that many things in Houston. He's definitely not a national figure in terms of endorsements, commercial endorsements. But, I would imagine that the football-related things that he has, whether it's gloves and shoes and all that, will stay the same. But there might be some hesitancy on the outside to link him to a product if in Houston, just for fear of what somebody might say.
You know, Richard Dawkins lost his toothpaste commercial contract. I know that. But we should say, actually, one of the things that emerges in your piece, we're talking to Tim Kuhn, a senior writer for ESPN, one of the things that emerges in your piece is this guy is, I mean, he's not a casual, if he's an atheist, and he doesn't especially like that word at the moment, if he's an atheist, he's A, not an atheist provocateur. So he's not Sam Harris. He's not Richard Dawkins. He's not going to run around and make a huge deal out of this outside of his conversations with you. And he's not casual about it either. I mean, he's very conversant with the work of Richard Dawkins. He's really interested in what Neil deGrasse Tyson has to say about a scientific view of the universe. This is a guy who's as likely to be at a Neil deGrasse Tyson lecture as studying his playbook, although the two are not exclusive of one another. I mean, once again, I found that surprising. Maybe that's something football fans knew about him.
Well, I think that not to the extent that we were able to get into it in this piece. I think he's been known as a thinker. He's gotten some mileage out of the fact that he writes some poetry, and he's been, you know, he's a pretty good, you know, he reads a lot, that kind of thing. But as far as, you know, going to see Neil deGrasse Tyson instead of going to a D'Angelo concert, which was the decision he made that night, I think that's kind of that's probably a new thing, and it's refreshing for people to see that he's that conversant in so many different things, and he's not making these decisions lightly. You know, whether, you know, you can argue his opinions and his beliefs all you want, but the fact is he's come to them through study. And interesting that he was raised a Muslim, so he was a little bit of an outsider to begin with, you know, especially in, you know, places like Albuquerque and where he grew up. And I think that has led him to be more of a student of religion. And, you know, he's read the Bible, he's read the Quran, he's very smart about these things. And he has in many ways, over many years, used his knowledge to sort of jab at people and to catch them in hypocrisies and so forth. And I think part of the reason that he decided to come out and discuss this was because he's trying to sort of soften a little bit and be someone that is more, he's asking for acceptance and in some ways pledging it as well, because he understands that he's been a little bit difficult in locker rooms and so forth. And as I write in the piece, there's probably not anyone who's shared a locker room with him who would be surprised to know that he is a non-believer.
I want to circle back to that in just a second, Tim Kuhn. Although I do want to say, bad decision. I've seen Neil deGrasse Tyson. He tours all the time. D'Angelo tours like once every 7 years. And American Messiah is an amazing CD. I think maybe Arian made the wrong move on that one. So one of the words that we've become accustomed to seeing about the NFL, anytime there's anything that runs contrary to this military-industrial complex mindset, is distraction, right? Michael Sam's going to be a distraction. So I'm sure there's people thinking, well, Arian Foster is going to be a distraction. Although what I've heard, I think Mike Pesca was the one who say, and when you really know about the focus of these guys, about what it takes to be that competitive, that dialed in, to compete at that level, the idea that they're going to be distracted by stuff like that is kind of ridiculous. I mean, they're thinking about their game and about winning in a way that we're not accustomed to in our jobs, where we might be distracted. I mean, do you think the word distraction is going to come up here?
It may come up, but I don't think it will be valid. I think that word is sort of an outsider's construct. I think that inside a locker room or a major league clubhouse, I think that the idea of a distraction is really kind of overblown. I mean, the distraction in some cases is being asked to discuss whether something's going to be a distraction or not. But I do think that, you know, I think that these guys are more adult than we give them credit for in a lot of ways. I think that they also handle their business individually more than we expect. I don't think that the guy that's, you know, the offensive tackle is looking across the locker room and, you know, deciding in his mind whether he's going to block for the guy who doesn't believe in God. You know, I just don't think that's a distraction that, these guys even consider. I think they're all playing for their jobs, they're all playing for their next contract, and they're playing to win. So, you know, I the fact that he's hurt sort of makes the point moot. He's going to be out for probably a minimum of 2 months, so I think the distraction is something that probably would have been relevant in this week and last week when the story first broke. But I think by the time he comes back, I don't think that distraction thing is even going to come up.
I never bought into that rumor that the theology of Hans Kung had really divided the 86 Bengals locker room. So I'm with you on that. Although I did note, I mean, you referenced the fact that he has an injury now. And I did note in a piece located near yours, the owner of the team kind of sighing and saying, "We're all getting very used to the Arian Foster soft tissue injury at the beginning of the season. It's just sort of part of our agrarian calendar here." And you almost, I could almost hear the implied, and maybe he should just shut up about all this stuff and do a few more stretches or something. You do sort of wonder, I mean, particularly if he remains injury plagued, how much people do in their invidious way start to link one thing with another.
Oh, definitely, and that's already happened on social media, and I've gotten emails from people, you know, that this was this was retribution, you know, that this guy got hurt the day before this story posted online. And yeah, I think the linkage is a little dubious at best.
You do describe this really fascinating relationship that he has for at least one season with this other player who's on the team for that one season, and it's kind of a Freud and C.S. Lewis debate. You know, they're kind of, this is a guy who is really serious about his faith, but really serious about his faith in a way that's open to discussion. And I mean, once again, I think most people's mental picture of an NFL locker room doesn't necessarily include this idea of these two guys having this long set of very serious and often scripture-based conversations about, you know, the deepest questions of life. I don't know if you want to say a little bit more about that.
Yeah, I think, Colin, I think I do, because it was such a, you know, there's always a point when you're reporting a story where you hit something and you think, you know, you just want to sort of get away from the person you're interviewing and sort of just do a little fist pump because you feel like you really got something you can, that sort of elevates the story. And I felt that way when Arian was discussing his relationship with Justin Forsett, who was on the team for 1 year, a fellow running back, because Forsett is the son of a preacher, very devout young man who would enter into these, as you say, these sort of involved and lengthy, sometimes days on end, discussions about religion and morality and whether they are, one can be there without the other. I found it really fascinating, and it sort of humanized both men, I felt, but it also gave some context to the way that Arian thinks, is that he was able to have these conversations that, in many ways, as Forsett said, it made him a stronger Christian. Instead of saying, "Oh my gosh, I've seen the light and Arian is correct," it was like he was forcing him through these challenges to sort of go back into his faith and sort of reflect on things that he might not have thought of, and it actually made him stronger in his beliefs. And you know, Arian talks about how Forsett is very accepting and non-judgmental, and says that he wants him, that he would like him to feel the feeling and the spirituality that he feels, because he not that he feels he's going to go to hell without it, but just that it means so much to him that he would like to have someone, his friend, feel the same way. And Arian's response was that was like the most divine thing he'd ever been approached with and that he'd ever heard. And so I think this relationship really gets to the heart of just this sort of acceptance and the fact that people can find common ground and that they can sort of exist within this culture of football and you know, to extend it to our country with these different beliefs and still respect each other. So yeah, that was a very important, to me, a very important part of the piece, was to get their relationship out there and sort of delve into it a little bit.
All right, we've got a call coming in from Eileen. I think this is a theological perspective as opposed to a football perspective, although she does have something to say about gap responsibility in the 3-4 too. Hi, Eileen.
Hi, Colin. Thank you for having me. Can you hear me?
Yes, just fine.
Good. Well, here's here's my thought. I just want to address the fact that God is totally aware of the football games, at the same time totally aware of all the wars, all the good things, the good weather today, at the same time aware of you and me. And not only aware, but totally present. And the reason is that God is simple. A thing that's simple has no parts. If it had parts, it would be corruptible. God can't be corruptible.
That is a terrific perspective, Eileen. First of all, I want to thank you for it very much. I think it's the kind of thing that Arianne Foster would enjoy discussing with you, and you'd make a formidable conversation partner for him. So thank you so much for calling the show today. We also have to thank Tim Kuhn. Eddie Lacy's running some Kierkegaard discussion groups for the Green Bay Packers. Tim has to fly out and attend those immediately. But Tim, great piece, longtime fan. Great to talk to you.
Oh, thank you, Colin. I appreciate it.
All right. We're going to take a little break. We're going to hold our breath. We're going to come back. We're going to talk about summer TV and maybe what's coming in the fall, too. Roger Catlin knows about both. All right. Last night was a hallmark moment in this summer's TV season as True Detective Season 2 ended. We found out that the guy in the bird mask was actually Jim Chapdelaine from The Nose, and that we probably shouldn't even have cared who the guy in the bird mask was in the first place. But summer TV is different now, and now joining us to talk about summer TV, and also he's in a place where he can know more than you know about what's coming this fall, is Roger Catlin, freelance writer whose work regularly appears in The Washington Post, blogs about television at RogerCatlin, that's with a C, .com, and he joins us from the TV Critics Summer Press Tour in Los Angeles. Many of you will remember Roger's long tenure writing about television right here in this market. So, Roger, welcome back to the Connecticut airwaves.
Hello, Colin. How are you?
Just fine. So, you know, summer television, when you and I were growing up, was this kind of a vast wasteland within a vast wasteland. I mean, there's every once in a while was kind of a innovative, perky little summer replacement series that was put on that didn't have a chance of survival in any other context. But, you know, not much there. And now it's its own thing, right? There's just this summer season that in some ways can be at times as interesting as the regular season. Is there even any point in making those kinds of demarcations anymore?
Well, I think networks have always said, you know, we're going year round. We're not a thing of just a season anymore. You know, viewers won't stand for reruns in the summer. But you know, the fact of the matter is, the reason I'm here for the press tour is they're talking about the fall, and what they're showing on the air and the networks, broadcast networks anyway, is not the kind of stuff they'd show in the fall. The kind of reality shows, and you know, they're usually kind of bad attempts at scripted shows that they buy from other markets, other countries, but they occasionally get good ones by mistake.
Well, I mean, in the sort of the whole cable universe, I mean, it is hard to make a distinction. True Detective, although, I mean, I think a lot of us felt it was an unsuccessful series this season, is, you know, I mean, it has an awful lot of critical credibility in general. And I don't know. I mean, I'm really enjoying Ray Donovan and Masters of Sex. And I mean, those all seem like things that could really run at any time of year.
Yeah, I think cable especially has followed this idea that you just, you run your things all year round. And I don't know, is summer a better time for TV than the fall? I guess people are on vacation, but on the other hand, they're also still looking for stuff to watch. With Sync streaming, they can watch anything, anytime, right?
Right. And so now people are in an odd, people who are listening to this segment, we're about to thrust them into an odd dilemma. Should you try to catch up on a summer series that Roger's about to mention, or should you try to catch up on one of the shows that's starting in late September or early October that he's also going to mention to you that maybe you haven't watched? Either way, you're probably screwed. You're going to have to watch 33 episodes of something that you've never seen before. So among the things that you watched this summer, Roger, did anything stand out?
I'm a fan of the show Rectify on Sundance, which nobody ever knows. But it's a very thoughtful, kind of quietly paced show about a guy who was on death row and comes out and tries to make a life 25 years later. And people are still trying to get him back into jail, and his family's trying to adjust to him being back, and he's trying to adjust to be back. It's good stuff. Very low key, but I enjoy it. I'm very intrigued by the True Detective. I didn't hate it as much as everybody else. There's a lot there. It's very dense. It's complicated. But the performances are very good. I mean, last night's finale was just so visually striking. There was hardly any dialogue.
Right. It grew on me a little bit. I will say it had sort of the mumblecore problem. I know two people, one of them being Heather Brandon, who is not an old person like me, who watched it with closed captioning because they couldn't understand the mumbling.
Yes, he might have overdone the noir mumbling a little bit. Vince Vaughn was getting into it a little too much, too, to be believable, maybe. But, it had ambition, and that's a good thing, you know, because a lot of times on television they're very lazy and they put on what they think people will like or have liked in the past, and that brings us back to network television, I guess.
Right. Well, I will say anyway, if people are wondering whether or not to take a stab at True Detective, be prepared to be confused a lot. But the performances are really good, and I do think Vince Vaughn, I've seen him once before in a dramatic role in which I thought he was very good too, and he certainly... You know, he had a lot of... by the end of it, I really thought, I understand this character. I believe in this character the way you should. So, you know, he's done his job.
Yeah, and they take chances on that show. It's a different story every season. I haven't heard if there's going to be a third season. I imagine there will be. It's written by one person. Last season was written and directed. There was one director for the whole season, too. That wasn't the case this season. But, you know, there's a central vision to the whole thing, which I think is I think Rectify is that way too. I think those are the shows to pay attention to where somebody sits down and writes the whole season rather than having a writer's room and, you know, kind of going here and there. And part of that is having shorter seasons too, just so they can kind of handle a whole story, you know, in 6 or 12 episodes rather than 24.
You know, I want to go back to Rectify for a second. That's a show. I have a little bit of a problem, and I think I might not be the only one. There's so much choice these days. There's so many things that you could conceivably watch, and I've fallen into this bad habit of watching 4 to 6 episodes of something, and even if I think it's kind of okay, I'll just stop because there's just so many other things that I could conceivably
do. You're on to the next thing.
Yeah, on to the next thing. And so I did watch quite a bit of Rectify and thought it was really good, and an attempt has been made, as you probably know, to connect it stylistically, or at least in matters of subject, to Serial, to the extent of I think one of the creators of Rectify starting her own podcast that mimics a little bit the style of Sarah Koenig.
Right.
And so that might be enough to lure a certain kind of person, maybe me, back into the Rectify web.
Well, I think when it was coming back this season, they put together a little thing that was exactly like Serial, to just kind of, I mean, it was a clever way of updating everybody on the story and doing it in that style. I don't think there's anything in the show itself that reflects that. It's just, I think it's all in their promotion department, have this kind of extra stuff around the show to kind of create a little buzz or get some audience they didn't have before.
So one of the things that I've been noticing is that, I mean, we know that the nerds have inherited the Earth, and usually when we say that, we're talking about the fact that comic book franchises and sci-fi and stuff has taken over. But now the nerds are being elevated to the status of heroes and leading players. And this, you know, was happening a bit in comedies like Silicon Valley, but now it's Halt and Catch Fire and Mr. Robot. These are not... series in which tech nerds are played for comedy. Maybe you can say a little bit more about what's going on with these.
It's funny how they use computers in all these shows, procedural shows. I mean, they make the computers look flashy. Normally, they have the screen on a piece of glass and they can point to it. But it's crazy because so much of our lives are online and in front of computer screens. There's no way to really kind of translate that into kind of some dramatic action. So I mean, the things about computers, yeah, they make sense and they're relevant. And *Halt and Catch Fire*, I think, is kind of an underrated show about that, and kind of similar to *Silicon Valley* in a way. Some of the storylines were exactly the same this year by accident, probably. But
it's about tech people doing a startup, right? Or
yeah, and they're burning down the house almost with all the electricity they're putting in there. But you know, it's interesting stuff, and I don't think it's. I mean, it's about something different. It's about, it's not a cop and it's not a hospital drama. You know, it's about something that we all have our hands on every day. So that's interesting about it.
Now, with Mr. Robot, first of all, I have to say that there's an aesthetic, a human aesthetic, that has been, for the most part, I think, undocumented. But I'm going to bring it up right now. And it involves people like Lizzie Kaplan from Masters of Sex, Zooey Deschanel, certainly Emma Stone. That's sort of that big-eyed, almost pop-eyed kind of look. To me, one of the things that's going on with Mr. Robot is that they said, what if we did a whole series in which, like, everybody had kind of big eyes, but sort of heavy-lidded big eyes, too? So like, the eyeballs on Mr. Robot I'm finding kind of distracting. I don't know if they're a metaphor for what happens when you look at your computer screen too long. But this is it also reminds me a lot of the old, old Darren Aronofsky movie, Pi, this kind of black-and-white movie about, you know, paranoia and hacking and flipping out about math and stuff. You're a TV critic. Explain to people what Mr. Robot is.
Well, it's about a hacker who is he's inside of a regular corporation, and he is enlisted to help a network of hackers to actually go after this. I think it's actually called Evil Corp, right?
Yep. Kind of pushing things a little bit. Actually, while you gather yourself for the rest of your explanation, let's hear just a little bit from Mr. Robot.
Submit to a bi-monthly drug test voluntarily. That's the only way that I'll recommend your release.
Hospitals. A heavily networked one like this are almost too easy to hack. This is William Highsmith. He's not only the head of the IT department here. He is the IT department. He's also an idiot. Not that I blame him, because the people that hire him are also idiots. The poor guy only gets a budget of about $7,000 a year, and he's supposed to protect their network from people like me. He never stood a chance.
That, by the way, is the lead character, and that's about as much emoting as he ever does. He never really kind of ventures out of that monotone. And Roger, I don't know if you've noticed this, but that the kind of burbly little techno soundtrack that the show prefers, I noticed that they'll bleed that over across about three scenes, you know? I mean, the same musical theme that's going blah, 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 blah. It'll be in a hospital, in a car, and someplace else. They won't change it somehow or other. It sort of thematically links what's going on. But so do you like Mr. Robot? Are you a fan?
I like how it's so distinctive, especially on USA, which kind of has been making its way with kind of shiny, humorous, almost lighthearted detective stories, and doing pretty well with it for years. And here's something very different, very dark. The acting of the lead character, Rami Malek, is really striking. I don't know any show that has Christian Slater in it is doomed.
Right. Well,
so that's a problem.
Well, everybody in the show is doomed anyway. You feel as though no one's coming out of this in a good place. And I agree. I think didn't USA do Burn Notice?
Yeah.
Okay. So, and you may remember infamously, Saturday Night Live had a quiz show called "What Is Burn Notice?" They were trying to figure out what it actually was. And I do think this is tonally a nice switch away from that kind of stuff. You do feel as though something interesting and deeply paranoid is happening here. But there's also kind of an unreliable narrator issue, right? Can you trust the focus of the main character, or could this be some weird? I mean, he's a drug addict and a hacker, and God knows what else. Can you even trust the person that you need to trust?
Yeah, you've got to go along on the ride with him to kind of figure it out. The thing for people to know about the show is that it doesn't involve robots.
No, there are no robots
they work on. There are at least two other series, or maybe three, if you include BattleBots. There are about robots, but this one is not.
Well, what Westworld is coming? Have you gone to the do a teaser out on the coast for Westworld yet?
They showed a clip of it, and. You know, it's pretty crazy, and it's I think they're disassociating themselves from the movie a little bit. Mm-hmm. I guess because people, most people die in the movie. I don't remember, but it's pretty lavish, you know.
Yeah. This is a new HBO series, and it is based on, wasn't it like Yul Brynner in Westworld? I mean, this is like a really old robot movie.
Right? Yeah. Yul Brynner, an old sci-fi thing about robots recreating a Western scene in the future that you go and visit. And it's much more psychological than that, it seems, in this HBO version. That is it J.J. Abrams who's doing it?
I think it might be, yeah.
Yeah, so it looks interesting. People are very interested in seeing more of it.
So
the thing I did see the first episode of that I'm very excited about for this fall is Fargo, new season, different year, mm-hmm. whole new cast.
Oh, whole new cast, wow.
You know, it goes back. It goes back to the woman Molly's father, who was the police officer turned diner owner, David Carradine, last year. Mm. When he was younger, he keeps talking about this case back that he had in Luverne, Minnesota, and this goes back to 1979. Mm. For that case, and it explores this whole time from the end of the 70s to the beginning of the 80s, where the country turned into this kind of Reaganite world. And in fact, Ronald Reagan appears in the new Fargo. A character playing him.
Yeah, I was going to say the ultimate cameo. So yes, I have to admit that I had the same experience with Fargo, except that I didn't have the experience of really really liking it and just wanting to continue.
You didn't like Fargo?
It just didn't work for me. No, and I couldn't even really explain why. I do want to say that we're talking to Roger Catlin right now. We now know that on October 4th, the world will come to an end, or at least there'll be some kind of black hole, because The Good Wife comes back, Homeland comes back, the leftovers come back, The Affair comes back. So that's going to be those are series where, in fact, you know, not everybody stayed with them. Some people never started them. Of that particular group, they're all coming back on the same night. Is there one that you would recommend that maybe people even try to catch up on before the fall comes?
I think the best of these shows all try to make them accessible for everybody when they come back for a new season. Especially Homeland, they have new stories that carries them through one season. So I think if you've never seen that, you can kind of jump in and be pretty sure
she's all the characters. She's crazy. Peter's in love with her. Mandy Patinkin's like always unhappy, no matter what's happening. That's pretty much covers it.
Even The Leftovers, as complicated and mysterious as that was, and with a lot of things left unexplained last season, really reboots this second season, what I've seen. They move to Texas. Mm-hmm. There's a town in Texas where people haven't been disappeared. So they all go there to start over. And the real reason is because production values are much less in Texas than they are in upstate New York. But they're rewriting the story. You know, they've gone way beyond the original novel and kind of winging it out there now.
Well, also, so, I can tell from the trailers, which I've seen, they're making a very smart move. More Carrie Coons as Nora.
She's fantastic.
She's the best character on this, and it looks like we're going to get a lot more of it. We're going to have to get a little less of this as we're winding up here, Roger, although I do have one comment that came up on our website. Somebody who has a good example of a show that they started watching and then stopped in the middle of, it's The Last Man on Earth. That's the Will Forte, Kristen Schaal vehicle. This person complains that then someone else shows up, and then someone else shows up, and then another person shows up on The Last Person on Earth.
Well, they're lying about the title.
Yeah.
And you could say that about Mr. Robot. But I think that is a very funny and very different comedy from Fox. I mean, it plays like a comedy, a big screen comedy. Then there are more characters coming this next season. But that was a very, I mean, I don't, maybe they just think they stopped in the middle because I think there were only six episodes.
All right.
First season to begin with.
I would watch Kristen Schaal do just about anything, including scream about tomatoes or whatever she's doing on that series. Roger Catlin, thanks so much for joining us. Catch up with Roger Catlin at rogercatlin.com, and he will tell you how to catch up with everything else. We're going to catch up with the Bernie Sanders movement in Connecticut after this.
I was not caught, though many tried. I live among you. Well, this guy.
only just now found out that The Leftovers is not a Food Channel show. Today's show was produced by Jonathan McPants, Tucker Ives, and me, Kyone Wolf. Our interns are Hallie St. Germain and Allison Ehrenreich. Greg Hill tweets for us at WNPR Colin and appeared in the intro with Tucker and Josh Nalea. The part of Bill Curry was played by Lance Armstrong. For show pages, articles, and videos of the Faith Middleton Show staff making a rapture omelet, the egg goes to heaven and you eat the shell, visit our website, WNPR.org. On tomorrow's show, we're live from New Haven with Mary Jane Foster. And now, back to Colin.
And I do want to say it's great to have Kyone Wolf back after her two-week vacation, although it means I have to write material for her, which interferes with my morning drinking. No more Bombay Sapphire at 11 a.m. Got to write the script. I did enjoy the relaxation, but I missed the voice. So it's great to have her and Greg back. And you may tweet at us. By the way, you may have trouble tweeting right now because we're about to talk about Bernie Sanders in Connecticut, and they may have broken Twitter because they're tweeting at us. But if you want to try to tweet at our tweet master, QB1 Greg Hill, it's at WNPR Colin, because we are going to talk about Bernie Sanders in Connecticut. And they do love their Twitter. They do love to make with the social media. So joining us right now are two supporters here in Connecticut of Bernie Sanders. Leo Canty and Audrey Blondin. They've both run for office in the past, and they've both been very active in Democratic politics, and now they are active on behalf of Bernie Sanders. So Audrey Blondin, I'm going to start with you. You know, I mean, the wisdom in Connecticut typically is we're not in our presidential politics cycle right now in August. We're not a highly contested state. We don't have that many electoral votes, blah, 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 blah. There's all kinds of reasons why there isn't, you know, a John Kasich office opening up across the street from you right now. There's why there isn't a Martin O'Malley something happening, you know, in the town green of Madison. Because it's just not going on in Connecticut in August of the off year. But it is with Bernie Sanders. So what's happening with you guys? Why are you organizing so early and so excitedly?
Well, first of all, thank you for having me. I too am just back from vacation, so I'm getting back in the groove here. What I was originally a part of Ready for Warren, which went on for about a year this past year through the winter. We had a meet up with her and maybe 20, 25 people here at the office in Torrington. As that wound down, it became more of a sort of ready for Bernie, feel the burn. So to answer your question directly, on July 29th, that was a Wednesday evening, they had a nationwide, again, for lack of a better term, like a meetup. I had expected about 35 people here at the office here in Torrington. We had over 80. We couldn't get in the door. And the most interesting part was, again, having done this more than 35 years, as Leo has, hello, Leo, that here in Democratic politics in Connecticut, it was amazing the amount of new people that had come out on a summer night at 7 o'clock to participate in a national Bernie Sanders meetup. I understand yesterday in Portland, Oregon, they had 28,000 people came out to see him. There's a movement, there's an excitement, there's a passion, there's a belief in Bernie, feeling the burn,
right.
And it's awesome.
That's the phrase. So Leo Canty, after many years as a union leader and a political figure and a sometime candidate for office, you quit all that and you had climbed to the top of a mountain. You were living in a cave. You were painting. You were just not really thinking about any of this kind of stuff. And now suddenly you're back. You're down from the mountaintop. You're not eating locusts and honey anymore. So what happened? Why is Bernie Sanders getting you back into the flow?
Well, it's not about me, Colin. It's about having a candidate running for president who's got the best shot of making the changes that most Americans want to see. I mean, we struggle with right on the top of the list is that big wage gap, and he's supporting minimum wage and trying to get take money out of politics and do a lot of the things that people are frustrated with, that we've lost control of our own democracy that's been handed over. You know, I've been waiting most of my life trying to find people to do that, but now I have the opportunity, so it didn't take me long at all to come off the mountaintop and do that. And hello back to you, Audrey. Glad to see you're one of many people that are getting plugged in.
Absolutely. And what was exciting at our event was we had a surprise special guest, Bill Curry. I didn't know he was coming. He traveled all the way out here to Torrington, and he spoke to the group. It was fabulous, fabulous.
He'll go anywhere. It's like just having a bear in your yard or something like that. I mean, it's just increasingly common as the wildlife population gets out of control here. I wouldn't make too much of having Bill Curry there.
Well.
So, Leo, so one question that I would have is this really about a bunch of activists and union people and, you know, readers of Bill Curry's left-wing Salon column trying to create enough noise to get the attention of Hillary Clinton and push her left on some of these issues before she's cemented into the nomination?
I think right now there's a whole bunch of people that have been waiting for some reason to become involved. I've met more people in this campaign who say they're first-timers having a house party, first-timers going to an event, first-timers ever donating or paying any attention to a political candidate for president. There is a growing population of disenfranchised people when it comes to politics. They see a venue, an outlet, a person who they trust and can feel can do something for our country, for our state. And I think they see that he's there. And so there are a whole bunch of people that are expressing their passion to get involved early, which by many standards it's early because the machine doesn't get to work.
Right.
But this is not a machine. These are volunteers. There are over 40 parties in Connecticut on that July 29th.
Correct, right.
There were over 1,000 people that showed up, many of whom had never been involved before. You know, we had this is just huge. And then if you look at that Portland event, people are showing up there. They're expressing themselves. And the fact of the matter is that this is all happening without a party structure, with no machine. Audrey's a volunteer. I'm a volunteer. We got pods all over the state of individuals who say, I like this guy enough that I'm going to do some work for him, and I'm going to go to town and do it.
Audrey, another thing that happened in Connecticut that may have disrupted machine politics was 2006, right? You had Ned Lamont challenging Joe Lieberman. And I'm sensing a little bit in the rhetoric and even in some of the names I see popping up here, a little bit of that feeling that at a certain point, one part of the Democratic Party in Connecticut just couldn't live with Joe Lieberman anymore and decided to go with Lamont, even though Lieberman had that position of an incumbent senator. Very tough thing to turn somebody like that from your own party out of office. Is this a little bit of the Lamont spirit carrying forward?
Well, I would say it possibly a little bit, but there, you know, I was a selectman for 10 years on the local level. I think in politics, you have a local level, you have a state level, you have a national level. And as Leo was saying, there are people that get involved on a national level in a national campaign that don't have never been involved before, and don't get involved in anything, even in a senatorial campaign, a statewide. They're just not engaged or not interested or not passionate about that level, but something about the presidential level. And remember, this is a state. Jerry Brown won the primary. Jesse Jackson won the state primary. The presidential politics in this state tend to be very progressive, and I think Bernie has captured that spirit, along with, I mean, we have some huge, again, as Leo was saying, some huge economic disparity issues in this state. We're one of the states that has the largest, if not the largest, disparity between the rich and the poor.
Right,
and that's a focus, you know, a huge focus at this point in time of Senator Sanders' campaign.
Audrey, I'm going to have to wrap it up right there. Thank you so much for joining us today. Tomorrow, speaking of machine politics, Betsy Kaplan and Jonathan McPants and I continue our journey into the dark heart of Bridgeport politics, this time with Mary Jane Foster, one of the candidates for mayor.
And it works so very hard for the people of America. Oh, 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 oh. Bernie Sanders.
Okay, red 39, blue 42, Huckabee, Huckabee, Huckabee.
Hill, is that the play? Because I don't
know. No, I just have the hiccups.